Australia's military history is more than just a collection of dates and the locations of war-ravaged battlefields. It is the stories of service and sacrifice of those who have answered the call of their country of birth or adoption and the enduring legacy they have created. Join me as we look into one of those stories. I'm your host, Ross Manuel, and welcome to I Was Only Doing My Job, Australia's Military History, a Doc Network podcast. Now let's get started. Hyacinth Ralph Honour was born on the 17th of August 1904 in Fremantle, Western Australia, the third of six children to Richard Joseph Honour, a police constable within the Western Australian Mounted Police, and his Irish-born wife Eleanor Iris Nee McMahon. His devotedly Catholic parents named him Hyacinth after Saint Hyacinth, whose feast day he was born on. However, during his formative years, he was repeatedly mistaken as female on paperwork, which caused him issues and no doubt a fair amount of childhood bullying, which had him informally go by the middle name Ralph, to whom he's known to history. He was educated at the Three Springs Primary School, roughly 313 kilometres from Perth, Western Australia's capital, and then later at the Perth Boys' School, which has the distinction of being the earliest government school in Western Australia. Life on a police constable's salary was not lavish, and Honour's early life was frugal, a trait that he would retain for the rest of his life. In 1917, he won a scholarship and attended the Perth Modern School, a high school in Subiaco, a suburb of Perth. His parents stayed in Three Springs due to his father's posting to the police station there, which had him boarding at the school. In his early teens, he was considered small and quiet by his peers, but was an academically adept student. In his final year of school, however, brought on by working at his farm property at Chetlam Park during breaks in the school term, he had a growth spurt, growing to 6 feet tall and becoming an accomplished athlete during his final year. While at the Perth School, he met Marjorie Collier Bennett, though her involvement in Honour's story comes much later. In 1923, he enrolled in the Claremont Teachers College and began a Bachelor of Arts at the University of Western Australia, majoring in English and Modern History. While he was studying there, he reunited with Marjorie Bennett, who was also studying to become a teacher. In 1924, Honour joined the 11th 16th Battalion of the Citizen Military Forces, and in 1925, the couple became unofficially engaged, as they lacked the money to get married. In 1927, Honour was promoted to sergeant and requested a discharge from the unit as he had completed his teaching qualifications and began working in Kalgoorlie. He received notification of his first teaching appointment while on holidays at Chetlam Park. The letter was addressed to, unsurprisingly, Miss Hyacinth Honour and advised her that she would to teach in Kalgoorlie. This was the last straw. He is reported to have said to his mother, "Mum, they think I'm a Sheila." And according to his biographer Peter Brune, all further references to Hyacinth Honour ceased, and from this time on, the man's name was Ralph Honour. Despite this clerical mix-up, Honour must have made an impression, as 2 years later, he was offered the position of senior housemaster at the Hale School in Perth. The Hale School is an independent Anglican boarding school and claims to be the first high school in Western Australia. While there, he boarded along with the students, who for some reason started to call him Reg. While he taught at Hale, he made the decision to enrol in night classes at the University of Western Australia to study a Bachelor of Laws degree, which he completed in 1933. While he studied, he represented the university in Australian football, rugby union, and athletics at the highest grades in the state. Following graduation, Honour would commence work at the prestigious Parker & Parker law firm, though at the time, Australia, like much of the rest of the world, was in the grips of the Great Depression. It was at this time also that Ralph and Marjorie discussed marriage, which would not have been an easy conversation to have at the time, as married teachers had to resign. Though not to be deterred, on the 2nd of June 1934, in the sacristy of the St. Patrick's Catholic Church in West Perth, the couple were wed in a small ceremony. Owing to the sheer number of siblings the couple had on each side and the fact that Marjorie wasn't Catholic, they had minimal support from their parents. The couple would settle in Nedlands, Western Australia, to a very Spartan life due to Honour's low income. Despite not being able to afford a radio license, according to Honour's sister Mary, the couple were happy and content and would welcome their first child, Richard Michael Honour, on the 28th of April 1936 at the Tresillian Hospital, Nedlands. 3 months later, Honour rejoined the militia, and their second son, Brian Ronald Honour, would be welcomed on the cusp of the Second World War on the 14th of June 1938. It would seem that Honour didn't continue the family tradition of naming his children after saints. When Honour rejoined the 11th 16th Battalion of the militia, he was appointed, owing to his age and previous experience, to the rank of Provisional Lieutenant, and when the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion was raised in October 1939, inheriting the honours and privileges of the militia unit of the same name as well as the unit raised during the First World War, who in turn could trace its origins and honours back to 1861, Honour was, owing to its incredibly low X number of WX15, one of the first to join. When the six colonial militaries were amalgamated in 1901, the process of issuing service numbers to personnel of the army was initially the responsibility of the individual regiment, where each infantry battalion, light horse regiment, and service corps issued numbers from its own series based on the order in which the person joined the unit, with officers and nurses not being initially issued service numbers to begin with. What this meant in practice was that every unit had someone holding the service number of 1, 2, 3, and so on. In 1914, when the first iteration of the Australian Imperial Force was raised, this practice was continued. And for anyone who's ever done family history understands the frustration of discovering their relative was one of 80 men who held the same number. Now, for the most part of Australia's early military history, this wasn't a serious issue. However, due to the industrial slaughter of men during the Great War, this necessitating the transfer of soldiers from one unit to another invariably resulted in soldiers within a unit having the same service number as someone already there. To remedy this, they simply gained the unique modifier of a letter at the end of their number, which didn't really fix the problem. In 1921, the practice of issuing service numbers was transferred to the military districts, something that I've mentioned before, but essentially, each state was broken down into seven military districts, with the Australian dominions of Papua and New Guinea being the eighth military district. Each state was responsible for the equipping, logistics, and training of all civilian forces within their state, as well as any members of the permanent forces. This meant that while each state did start with the same number, they each gained a letter to correspond with the district, for example, W123, which would relate to the person from the Western Australia being the 123rd person to enlist. Soldiers who were in the permanent forces also had a P in their army number, aka WP123, and women had F or WF123, and this number stayed with them regardless if they transferred into a unit from a different state. For the second raising of the Australian Imperial Force on the 28th of September 1939, this saw a modification to the existing service numbers. As the 1903 Defence Act prohibited established military units from being deployed overseas, those who volunteered for overseas service were given a new army number corresponding to the military district they enlisted in, were given an X to prevent duplication with members of the citizens' forces, for example, WX123. Soldiers who transferred from the militia to the AIF briefly gained an M, aka WMX123, but due to tensions between the AIF and the militia that I'll go into later, this practice was discontinued in 1942. Ralph Honour joined the Australian Imperial Force on the 24th of October, 1939, and was appointed to the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion at the rank of lieutenant. At the time, roughly half of the officers of the battalion either came from the 11th or the 16th Cameron Highlanders of Western Australia. It was at this time that Honour would reunite with a number of men from his past, including several boys he taught and others that he practiced law with. Honour was quickly promoted to temporary captain, commanding officer of C Company, 2nd 11th Battalion. Now, while soldiers were generally allotted to their companies at recruitment, Honour was more hands-on and interviewed the men who came through his recruitment district, selecting largely farmers, miners, and sportsmen from Kalgoorlie to join his company. Honour was proud of the men under his command, and they in turn respected him, giving him the nickname Jump, though it is unclear as to how many men of the company were former students of his or where Jump came from. Honour and his company started their training at the Northam Camp while it was still being constructed, before receiving orders to relocate to Sydney to join the rest of the 18th Brigade. By the time the battalion settled at the Ingleburn Camp, Honour was officially promoted to the rank of captain. Owing to the effects of the Great Depression on the Australian industry and the successive slashing of defence budgets, meant that there was little room for expansion or modernisation, nor was there a stockpile of weapons to which to raise a volunteer force. This resulted in the unit training using weapons and equipment surplus to what their fathers and uncles would have used 20 years prior in the Great War. The 2nd 11th returned to Perth at the end of March 1940, and engaged in a brief exercise period before sailing for the Middle East on the 20th of April on the British troop ship HMT Y3 Navassa. The Navassa left the wharf at 12:10 p.m. and anchored in Gage Roads before sailing at 3 p.m. on the 22nd of April 1940. From accounts, the Navassa, a vessel designed for short four-day journeys and had been used as a hospital ship during the Great War, was not designed for the six-week voyage from Fremantle to the Middle East, and owing to the skeleton crew on board, a lot of the daily running of the vessel, according to Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Louch, fell to his troops. Honda was also not intent in letting his troops slack off during the voyage, even going so far as to have his corporals sign resignation forms that he could use in the event that they did not live up to his expectations. An act, had someone had issue with, would have been disastrous to Honda's career, as he lacked the moral and legal authority to force them. Thankfully for him, no one objected. Honda wanted the best company, and his men wanted to be the best. The Navassa arrived in Colombo on the 3rd of May 1940. While she subsequently arrived in Kantara, Palestine on the 17th of May, it did not disembark until the 19th, when Honda and the rest of the 2nd 11th Battalion entered the Kilo 89 camp in what is now Gaza to continue training. Interestingly, memories of Australian forces rampaging through Cairo during the First World War were apparently still fresh in the memories of Egyptian authorities, which caused the Egyptian government to insist that Australian forces be trained out of the country, despite being sent there to defend the Suez Canal. And when they trained, they continued to do so in the same Great War vintage weaponry, often in the same camps their predecessors trained in. As unfortunately, events occurring in Europe caused the supplies from England to not arrive, as they were needed back at home due to the German attack through the Ardennes Forest that threatened the British Expeditionary Force, leading to the evacuation of Allied personnel at Dunkirk, a week after the arrival of the Australians in Egypt. For more context, I touched on this briefly with my chat with Melissa Ratliff during our Save Sundowner episode. On arrival in the Middle East, the 2nd 11th was reassigned to the newly raised 19th Australian Infantry Brigade, a move brought on by the decision of the Australian Imperial Force to adopt the British Triangular Division System over its previously established Square Division System. Now, if that makes absolutely no sense, I will attempt to translate as it made no sense to me when I first read it. Essentially, a triangular division reorganized the infantry division from four battalions in a square structure to a three battalion. This rule of thirds model was ideally designed to allow a third of a combat force to participate in action, a third to prepare for future actions, and a third recuperating, and this was duplicated at every level from the brigade down to section. This style of military organization had been largely adopted following the Great War, and while Australia had a square or rule of half model at the time, it routinely had all four elements rotating into and out of the line. What this meant was the division could be more mobile, as it comprised of fewer personnel, and could be used to exploit in advance or provide support in a defense. The other advantage that this shift had is it allowed more units to be raised out of the same number of recruits. Now, not to be deterred by the lack of equipment and the new assignment, Honda continued in his expectation that his company was going to be the best in the brigade, no matter which one that was. So C Company, as a matter of pride, was required to march further, much faster, and dig in when its march to a venue was completed, no matter what the time of day was or the physical state of the troops. Despite being, in most cases, 10 years older than most of the troops under his command, Honda easily kept in pace with his men. Occasionally, his battalion had leave, which, considering these young, virile men were away from their families and loved ones, inevitably meant some frequented local brothels. Honda, as did many officers in the division, had the occasional task of supervising both the premises and the soldiers. When asked if he partook in local comforts, he answered, quote, "No, first on moral grounds, and secondly, Marjorie would have known," unquote. After 6 months at Kilo 89, in November 1940, the 2nd 11th moved to, and I apologize here, Berg il Arab, which is roughly 48 kilometers from Alexandria, to join the rest of the 19th Brigade for exercises with the rest of the 6th Division, which had been relocated following the Italian invasion of the Kingdom of Egypt. The exercise called for the 19th Brigade to defend Berg il Arab, and for the 16th and 17th to attack the town. Owing to Honor's drilling of his men, C Company raided the 17th Brigade Battalion headquarters three times, capturing the unit's battalion commander each time. The outcome? The battalion commander was relieved of his command by the time the 6th Division saw its first involvement in the war. Now, before we continue with the 6th Division's entry into the war, I'm going to take a minute to share a word from our sponsors. This episode was made possible thanks to the generous support from our backers, whose donations go towards paying for distribution and streaming costs, the digitization and procurement of records, as well as everything else that goes into making a podcast. And if you enjoy what we do here at I Was Only Doing My Job and want to support the podcast directly and get some sweet rewards in the process, follow the link in the episode description or visit our website to buy the podcast a coffee, either as a one-off or as an ongoing subscription. At the lowest tiers, you'll get episodes early and ad-free, and at higher tiers, you'll get a mention in the episode and even the ability to suggest future topics. For more information, check the link in the episode description or check out www.thedocnetwork.net. And now, let's get back to the show. On the 9th of September, a massive force of 215,000 Italian troops crossed the Egyptian border from Libya and made impressive gains in a relatively short time, in concert with land invasions of Kenya, Sudan, and British Somaliland, before the Italian viceroy, the Duke of Aosta, ordered his troops to halt and fortify their positions on the 16th of the month. This act immediately handed the initiative to Lieutenant General Archibald Wavell of the Middle East Command and the considerably smaller Western Desert Force, who on the 9th of December 1940 launched Operation Compass. Compass was a five-day raid on Italian positions led by Major General Richard O'Connor, and at the head of a force of 36,000 men, 275 tanks, 120 guns, and 142 aircraft against the Italian fortifications in occupied Egypt. The 7th Armored Division and the 4th Indian Division were instrumental in this initial phase and attacked the Italian positions at Sidi Barrani, delivering a stunning defeat. The position was captured and 38,000 Italian soldiers were taken prisoner, the first of 130,000 Italians who would end up being captured during the raid. Defeated, the remainder of the Italian force was driven back across the border into Libya. The 7th Armored Division, following suit, established itself west of Bardia, cutting off land communications between the strong Italian garrison there and Tobruk, 96 kilometers away. On the 11th of December, the 4th Indian Division was withdrawn from the Western Desert Force and sent to the Sudan to participate in the East African campaign. In response, the 16,000 strong 6th Australian Division under Major General Ivan Mackay was brought forward from Egypt, despite being under-equipped, largely inexperienced, and according to some senior officers in both the Australian and British commands, incredibly under-trained. Despite this opposition, the 6th Division was immediately put in the line in the British right flank and was about to experience its baptism of fire at a tiny village on the Egyptian-Libyan border called Bardia in what would be the Australian Army's first action of the Second World War. Located in the Libyan region of Cyrenaica, Bardia is roughly 30 kilometers from the Egyptian border, which, following Italy's colonization of the region, became a fortified outpost with a 29-kilometer-long string of defensive outposts, barbed wire, concrete bunkers, and trenches around the town and its small harbor. To quote Major Henry Marshall from the 6th Division, the Italians had spent a number of years developing Bardia and they considered it impregnable. They had made the terrain inside and outside the wire as bald as a billiard ball and had constructed concrete posts along the wire in two rows. It was impossible to use any cover as there wasn't any. The official Australian war historian Gavin Long described it as, quote, a great expanse of labour, steel and concrete. They had dug a defensive line in the form of an arc 18 miles in length round the little harbour and garrison town. They consisted of an almost continuous anti-tank ditch and behind it a double line of underground posts, the front line being linked by rows of barbed wire. The posts in the forward lines were generally about 800 yards apart and were protected by their own anti-tank trench. They were armed with one or two 47mm guns and from two to four machine guns. The guns were fired from concrete-sided pits connected by trenches with a deep underground shelter which occupied most of the area of the post. 400 yards behind the forward line lay a second arc of posts, similar but lacking an anti-tank trench and sometimes without wire. Within this perimeter, aerial photography revealed a considerable array of artillery, estimated at 110 guns, and some long stone breastworks. Each flank of the line lay on the inner bank of one of the steep-sided wadis carved into the cliffs forming a coast from the Saloum northwards. And elsewhere, the posts were in flat, almost featureless ground, offered little cover for the attacker and few landmarks, unquote. While the men of the 6th Division may have been inexperienced, the men in charge of the brigades and the division itself were all experienced officers from the Great War and knew the ins and outs of attacking an entrenched, fortified opponent, with all seeing extensive service on Gallipoli and the Western Front in battalion and brigade-level commands. The plan orchestrated by General Mackay called for Brigadier General Arthur Tubby Allen, yes, the same Tubby Allen who was in command of the 45th Battalion during the First World War, and the same officer who told John Barney Hines that this new war was a young man's war, and to hear more about his story, check out The Souvenir King of the AIF, that's episode 2 of season 1. Well, Tubby Allen's 16th Australian Infantry Brigade was to attack the western side of Bardia's defences supported by tanks from the 7th Royal Tank Regiment, with Brigadier General Stanley Savage's 17th Australian Infantry Brigade in position to exploit the breakout, while Honor and the rest of Brigadier General Horace Robertson's 19th Brigade were in Division or Reserve. These men were also supported from the sea by the Inshore Squadron commanded by Captain Hector MacDonald Laws Waller, the focus of Episode 32, and in the air by elements of No. 3 Squadron, Raw's Terrain Air Force, commanded by Squadron Leader Peter St. George Bruce Turnbull, the focus of Episode 12. British and Australian intelligence estimated that the Italian garrison contained about 25,000 soldiers. The Australian attack was to be evaluated against the superb record of the 1st Australian Imperial Force, and the initial results were stunning. On the 3rd of January, 1941, at 0530, under the thunder of 900 artillery pieces, the 16th Brigade swept through the Italian defences and almost immediately found that the collection and supervision of its demoralised enemy presented its greatest problem. The anticipated 25,000 Italians were actually 40,000 in strength, and they were surrendering en masse. Which, it was at this juncture that a certain degree of controversy entered the Bardia battle. When the 17th Brigade sought to exploit the 16th Brigade's success, its progress was not as speedy as anticipated. An official historian, Gavin Long, would write, quote, "During the morning of the 4th of January, while Savage was planning to end the Italian resistance in the pocket his brigade had now surrounded, by making a night attack from the north and west, he did not know that, at the same time, Mackay's staff were writing orders for an attack through his area the next morning by the fresh 19th Brigade with tanks and behind an artillery barrage. While this attack was being made, Savage's battalions were to stand and watch the new troops pass," unquote. Essentially, the tried but resolute 17th Brigade had been halted not by the enemy, but by bureaucracy. Brigadier Robertson chose the 2nd 11th Battalion to lead the attack, with the 2nd 4th ready to exploit and the 2nd 8th assigned to protect the left flank and clear the coastal area. While Honor could not have known when and where the 11th Battalion was going to go into battle, he had taken precautions to ensure his company would be the first involved, as he had extracted a promise from the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Louch. Honor had the foresight to record his actions extensively in letters to his wife in as much detail as possible that proved invaluable in chronicling his involvement in the war, while each letter to Marjorie during his Middle East campaign began and ended with words that portray his deep and abiding love for his wife, they were also 500-word missives about his conduct in the war. His first letter is a case in point. It begins with, quote, "My best beloved," and concludes with, quote, "It is growing too dark to write sweet, so on the wind I whisper I love you." Between those two heartfelt messages is the approximate 4,000-word Bardia diary, which is experiences of the 4th to the 16th of January, 1941. The handwriting is apparently only 3 millimeters in height to facilitate the approximately 700 words per page. Because military censors had a list as long as your arm on things and phrases you couldn't write about to maintain operational security, Honor referred to the 16th Brigade as the Push Brigade, as in P is the 16th letter of the alphabet, and comparatively, the 17th Brigade became the Quiet Brigade and the 19th became the Shock Brigade. There's also some controversy about his opinions of the other two brigades. In the morning of the 5th of January, Honor and his three platoon commanders set out to examine the ground that Honor had expected the battalion was going to attack. After unknowingly encountering a portion of the 2nd 5th Battalion near the Skemmis Wadi, Honor climbed back into the truck he'd been travelling in and headed out across the flat, featureless no man's land, not realizing that in the process he'd just left the front line of the 17th Brigade. He followed a line of telegraph posts that he determined would be useful as a visual landmark to serve as his company's starting line, and as he inspected the area, his attention on the telegraph poles, and I'll leave what happened to Honor directly in his letter to Marjorie. Quote, "We saw we were in the middle of an Italian artillery battery with 100 men within 100 yards of us. I leapt back into the truck and got my pistol while Katie Johnson, one of the platoon commanders, seized the driver's rifle. At that, the four nearest Italians put their hands up. They couldn't see we were alone as they were in a gully and we had just driven up to the edge of it. I yelled, 'Avanti, advance,' and to insert racial epithet for the Italians, up they came," unquote. Honor then ordered his driver, Private Quinlan, to turn the vehicle round and leave the engine running while the four prisoners were loaded into the back to ensure that the party would not be fired on as they beat a hasty retreat. Honor had therefore reconnoitred the ground in which he would soon stage an attack and returned with four prisoners in the process. When Honor and his party returned to battalion headquarters, they had only just received their attack orders for 0915. And as promised, Honor's company was in the front of the attack, with six infantry tanks in support under his command. Colonel Louch would have had more than enough justification to request an alteration or delay to the artillery timetable, But as he served in the Great War, he was unfortunately well aware of the consequences to meddling in the carefully planned artillery plans at the very last minute. And this was stressed to Honner and his platoon commanders that C Company would have to keep up to the artillery barrage plan regardless of the time and distance. It probably would have been prudent, considering that Honner had only 45 minutes to get from battalion headquarters to his company headquarters half a mile away, where they had bedded the night before, a trip he completed in 15 minutes. He then had to get the unit equipped, briefed, and off to the starting location 3 miles away in half an hour. Now, I looked up 3 miles in half an hour, and I actually found that the United States Marine Corps has a 3-mile run fitness test, which is apparently the toughest running event in military fitness training, and the participants are expected to complete it in 28 minutes or less. Now, that's in PT gear. Honner's C Company soldiers were equipped with their weapons, 100 rounds of ammunition, 4 grenades per section, steel helmets, 1 day's ration of bully beef and biscuits, respirators, a haversack, and some in their long underwear and balaclavas. They then double-timed it to the start line where they went straight into battle and did so 2 minutes slower than the most grueling fitness test in the military. Now, this is a testament to Honner's demanding standards of the physical fitness and training of his men. As the company moved forward, they passed about 100 prisoners. As the company moved forward, they passed about 100 prisoners who were the Italians Honner's small reconnaissance party had captured earlier that morning. He met up with the 6 tanks, and after a brief liaison occurred concerning proposed tactics and communications. As the artillery creeping barrage concluded, the Italians took their turn, firing with such accuracy, Honner was convinced the Italians had pre-sighted the same telegraph line that he had chosen as his starting off point. Although the Italian artillery quickly gained the reputation for ineffectiveness, the ferocity of this initial barrage was burnt into his memory and would influence his planning later on in the war. Pushing through the barrage, Honner and his men were then met with a hail of machine gun fire, while the men of his company went to ground on the featureless expanse in a scene that reminded me very much of episode 3 of the HBO series Band of Brothers, The Attack on Carentan. Captain Honner remained standing, moving between his platoons, chastising them, pointing out that there were no casualties, and that even against the high volume of fire, fast dispersed orderly movement would keep it that way. While few men of C Company would have been able to hear his pearls of wisdom, though I'm not sure how eloquent his persuasion was, enough started to move, either by embarrassment of seeing their leader on his feet moving around and drawing fire while they hid in the dirt. The reaction was infectious. C Company rose and pressed on. Owing to the lack of time to train and coordinate between infantry and armor prior to the attack, when an Italian position had been identified, section or platoon commanders would rush to the side of the tank and, quote, point his rifle with steel helmet on the bayonet at the enemy position, unquote. The tank either induced the enemy to surrender or kept their heads down long enough for the infantry to deal with him. Lieutenant Katie Johnson, platoon commander of C Company, remembered banging on the tank with his rifle butt and was told by a rather irate tanker that rifle pointing and hitting tanks was unnecessary, as there was a phone positioned at the rear of the tank to facilitate communication. Can imagine how that conversation went. Under the ferocity of the Australian troops, the Italian positions were quickly overrun and large swaths of Italian troops surrendered. Honner described the demoralized Italian prisoners as, quote, a long broken column winding back like a great segmented serpent over the skyline to the rear, unquote. And in a letter to Marjorie, quote, the only thing that held us up was dealing with prisoners. They had to be disarmed, and with large batches, that meant a platoon was held up. But I always swung up the reserve platoon to keep up the 2-platoon front while the prisoners were being sent back, leaving instructions for the 3rd platoon to follow, unquote. With C Company's objectives achieved, it's best to listen to the man himself as he summed up both C Company's battle and his own performance. Quote, our success was due to the speed and resolution shown in the attack by our comparative freedom from casualties was miraculous all the same. All officers, NCOs, and men behaved splendidly, and if I take any credit, it is for keeping up the speed of the attack. I moved in front between the 2 leading platoons and kept the boys on the run through shell fire and machine gun fire, which looked and sounded as bad, but wasn't hurting anyone, unquote. The official history records 1 2nd 11th Battalion casualty for the battle. Given the intensity of fire, the ground gain, the posts captured, and the prisoners taken, this must have been a dream start by Honner to an illustrious military career. The 2nd 11th stunning success at Bardia at such a frugal cost in casualties sat most comfortably with all except for the battalion medical officer, Lieutenant Colonel Louch, would later write that, quote, Killer Ryan, the RMO, had established his regimental aid post at a convenient spot under the bank of a wadi, which he had prepared to receive and treat anything up to 100 wounded. When no one arrived, he got worried and thought he must have been in the wrong place, so he left his aid post and set out looking for other patients. Unquote. General O'Connor's next objective was the capture of Tobruk, chiefly because the acute shortage of transport within his command had meant that his force was now short on petrol, water, and ammunition. Many of these demands have been supplemented by capturing Italian vehicles and supplies, but as his line of communication lengthened, so his supply problems magnified. The capture of the port of Tobruk would enable him to move supplies by sea direct from Egypt, and will be the focus of our next episode. And there you have it, folks. That is part one of the life, service, and legacy of Captain Ralph Honner. Next episode will continue with Honner's involvement in the capture of the strategically important settlement of Tobruk. So until next time, friends, bye. Works cited in this episode are Ralph Honner, Kokoda Hero by Peter Brune, the service record of Ralph Honner, the unit diaries of the 2nd 11th Australian Infantry Battalion, the 19th Australian Infantry Brigade, and the 6th Australian Division, and the website of the Australian War Memorial. Thanks for listening to the I Was Only Doing My Job Australia's Military History Podcast, a Doc Network production. This episode was recorded on the lands of the Gangdangara people, whose elders have passed on knowledge for thousands of years, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. This episode was written, researched, produced, directed, and audio engineered by me, Ross, with additional research done by Laurie Favell of My Silent Hero. If you do know someone whose story needs to be told, feel free to leave a comment on an episode or send us an email at iwasonlydoingmyjobpod@gmail.com. If you like what we do here and you want to support this podcast, the best thing you can do is share this with a friend or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, as it really helps others find the show. And if you want to join in on the conversation, join us over on Discord. And if you want more content, including show notes, photos, transcripts, and my various adventures finding memorials dotted around Australia, head over to our website at www.thedocnetwork.net and follow the show on all our social media pages at IWODMJ. Don't worry, there are links to everything in the show notes. Join me personally for more bite-sized history over on TikTok and pretty much everywhere else at Doc Winters. All opinions expressed in this episode are solely those of the speaker and don't reflect the views or opinions of any entity, agency, or organization. It is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time. Bye.